She's always been the type of person that just says things and she just speaks her mind. I guess that has a little bit to do with not having a formal education.
Welcome to the very first episode of The Body Serve. I'm Jonathan.
I'm James.
And this is our very first tennis podcast.
Woo!
We're going to be taking a look back at 2014. Even though the tennis season has already started, we feel like there is some stuff to say about last year before we head into 2015. But before we start, we're going to challenge the listeners to listen to our intro and tell us where that is from. Anything you want to add to that?
You may notice that it's the alpha and omega of tennis reads, in my opinion. It's the primordial shade of modern tennis.
The birthplace of
I
shade.
I hope that's a clue.
And that queen of shade still reigneth.
She doth.
So let's begin with Rafa. I feel like most tennis discussions in this day and age, it's almost as if the tennis world pivots on Rafa, the axis of Rafa.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
He started off in fine form, coming off of the US Open in 2013, headed into Australia with a fair bit of confidence for a tournament that hasn't always been his best Grand Slam. Reached the final, looked like a win was inevitable, and then, of course, that final happened. His back betrayed him. And then all of that spring happened.
Yeah. I remember watching the final and thinking it was so unbelievable that he could lose. You know, I think it took me half the match to accept that it was even possible that he could lose.
I remember
it was excruciating.
I remember distinctly leading up to that final, especially after the year that Stan had in 2013 in the Grand Slams, telling you that it wasn't going to be a cakewalk.
Yeah.
Yes, I remember that. I'll take points for that. It gave me no pleasure with the eventual outcome, though, I'll tell you that.
Okay, I was the Stan denier.
But then the spring happened, and in previous years, we just expected Rafa to bulldoze his way through the clay court season, right. And that didn't really happen.
No, not at all.
But go ahead.
Well, he actually won the tournament that he hates the most. You know, he won Madrid, and that's kind of the one, as a Rafa fan, I don't really care if he wins, because I think it's, I don't know, I just don't like the tournament, I don't like the clay.
There is a small caveat, though, that before Nishikori really showed signs of injury, that it didn't really seem like Rafa was on his way to winning that match.
That's true. But
Which also added to the whole general feeling that this was not like his regular clay season. He right. played 6 tournaments, lost 3 matches. One of them was at Nishikori final, which he probably should have lost.
Mm-hmm.
And so that all led into Roland Garros when, you know, heading into the earlier rounds, it didn't really feel like it was a sure thing, unlike other years.
Mm-hmm.
And then he eventually did it.
Yeah, and it seems so routine. You know, I don't really even remember much of the final. I don't remember it being very exciting. It just seemed inevitable, you know?
Well, Djokovic wasn't at his best physically in that final either. It was a bizarre match. Yeah. I remember writing about the preview for that final and thinking we're in for a blockbuster. You know, this is where everything's going to come together, where maybe Djokovic is going to finally do it, you know, and it was a bit of a letdown.
Yeah. I mean, Djokovic has beaten him numerous times on clay now in similar conditions. You know, in Rome, which they say is a good warm-up for Roland Garros because the conditions are similar. So it's funny to me that he's never been able to do it, and it seems like purely a sort of a mental hurdle at this point.
Absolutely, because at that point, Djokovic entered the US Open final as a favorite.
Right.
He entered the French Open with as much steam as he's ever had against Rafa at Roland Garros, and neither time he was able to do it. So it leads me to believe that there's something more at play there with the two of them.
Yes.
Agreed.
I think also, You know, Novak doesn't really feel loved in Paris. And I know that Rafa doesn't either. But it seems like almost everywhere that Novak plays, the crowd is against him. And I think he seems like a player who really thrives on that atmosphere. You know, he's not motivated by the hatred like Jimmy Connors was. Novak likes to be the entertainer, and he gets really disheartened, and you can tell when the crowd is rooting heavily against him.
And I'm sure it didn't help that his body didn't feel that great that day as well.
Right.
You know? So Rafa got through the French Open in pretty good stead, as it turned out. Headed to Wimbledon, won a few matches, which in itself felt like a victory after the last 2 years.
I honestly thought if he got through, say, like three rounds, he really had a good chance of winning.
Which is what he did. And then he ran into Kyrgios.
Yeah. Which is a match I think he should have won. You know, but I guess there was some other, you know, his back was still bothering him. Some other stuff was going on. I don't know. I don't think Kyrgios on another day should have beaten him.
I was really looking forward to seeing Rafa the rest of the year. Because I felt like the narrative of his season was cut short. Like we might have been able to learn so much more about Rafa, in the tennis world that we just weren't able to. You know, the struggles after Australia, winning at the French, how was he going to put that together then on the hard court season? You know, it would have been something different for tennis viewers to see. And I'm really kind of sad that we didn't get to see that.
Yeah. I mean, the rest of the year for me, from my biased perspective, was such a letdown. The Wimbledon final was exciting, of course, but I don't know. You know, men's tennis just didn't have that spark for me. And I think a lot of people agree.
I mean, regardless of how you feel about Rafa, tennis needs him.
Yeah.
Like, we went to the Rogers Cup. Everybody was there except for Rafa, and it was clear that there was something missing.
Right.
And it wasn't just a bias thing that we were feeling.
You know? No, because you could hear people talking about him.
Where's Rafa? Mm-hmm. I will say that it was something else to see Federer in person and that close. But even then, like, the draw is just missing some serious heft when the prospect of facing Rafa just isn't there.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about Rafa in terms of what we're looking forward to him from him in 2015 a little bit later on, but we're going to continue on with some more things that happened last year that were of interest to us. And of most interest to you is the year of Miss Serena Williams.
Which is the same every year. where to start? I mean,
well, let's just lay it out there what her stats were for 2014. She played 7 finals. She won all 7 of them. She won a Grand Slam. Like, that in itself, for almost any player, is just a winning season.
Yes.
But the entire year just felt a little bit off. Even when she was winning, it was a bizarre year.
Well, yeah. You know, she won some important tournaments. She won Miami, which I think was her 7th or 8th time. I should know that. She won Rome, you know, Cincinnati. These are the premier tournaments that aren't Grand Slams, right? But kind of the layperson only cares about the Slams. And especially when you're talking about an all-time great so late in her career, what we really care about is, can she add to the total?
But she also, for somebody who was 33 and people are worrying about her age and being able to keep with it physically, she finished the year pretty strongly. She won the U.S. Open, she won Cincinnati, then she went and won the tour finals as well.
And to me, like, when she was losing, it didn't seem like her body was breaking down, you know?
Are you trying to say something further than that?
No.
Well, what then would be the reason for her losing?
I think, you know, you could tell she was nervous in big moments, and she talked about it more openly than she normally has. She's somebody who, it turns out, cares a whole hell of a lot about numbers. You know, she really, really wanted to join Chris and Martina at 18. And I think every time those matches got tough, that sort of weighed on her.
I remember reading a lot of previews for the 2014 season and seeing a lot of people talking about how how important number 18 was to Serena, and how much pressure it would cause her. And I was very skeptical, you know, like,
yeah,
I guess I didn't feel like Serena would be affected that much by pressure, or as you said, nor would she care that much about it. But
well, I think age is a big factor too. You know, she realized sort of late in her career, right, that her tennis life is going to be
finite. Yeah.
It's you know, it's going to end sometime in her 30s, probably.
We're still not sure about that.
We're not sure. But for the normal athlete, right? So I think, you know, she obviously respects her predecessors a lot. You know, she and Venus both say that Billie Jean King taught them so much and that she's given so much to the sport. And same with Martina and Chris and Steffi and Monica. You know, the Williams sisters do have a sense of history.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something that I think really motivates Serena to get up there with those people she respects. So, you know, losing to Ivanovic in Australia was kind of the first, like, the first crack for me. It was like, okay,
she's really nervous. Very surprised by that.
I was extremely surprised.
But then Ivanovic went and made the season count, not so much at the Grand Slams, but, you know, it wasn't that terrible of a loss in that she did have a good comeback
year.
Yeah,
and I was really happy for that, actually. Because it wasn't, you know, it wasn't just a fluke win for Ivanovic.
It wasn't a loss to Cornet, is that what you're saying?
Exactly. Which, I don't know, like, I'm a student of Williams, but that is still confounding to me.
Well, every time it happened again, you felt like it couldn't possibly happen again. Like, you wanted to buy in wholeheartedly to the narrative that, you know, Serena had just been just gearing up to just clobber this girl.
Yeah.
In the next time, and it just never happened.
Well, I'm a true optimist as a fan, you know? I always think, because we've been so spoiled by the very strange careers of Venus and Serena, I always think there's a comeback, another comeback down the lane, you know? So when Rafa's out for 6 months, I know he's going to come back and win the French because he's had such a strange career, right? And so that's how I feel as a fan, that, oh yeah, Serena will come back and beat this girl. Like, no problem.
Well, I think that's a very important part of how we collectively have viewed her 2014 season. In the past, she's been able to come back with little or no match practice, dominate, look flawless, and then she just carries on.
Yeah.
It just looks a little bit more difficult for her now, which makes total sense.
Yeah.
You know, she's getting up there in age. It makes sense that someone should need time on the practice courts to then perform, you know, in a Grand Slam. And maybe that's just what we're seeing. She's just having to put in more of the hard yards. You know?
Yeah. Well, in the past 3 years now, she's had more conventional seasons, right? Mm-hmm. She's played an average number of tournaments, and she's actually done well in the small tournaments. So yes, she's playing more matches than she has ever. You know, even when she was 2021 playing the Serena Slam, she only played like 60-something matches a year at the most, you know?
You know, I'm a big fan of Serena Williams, not nearly on the same level as you are.
Correct.
But my fandom of Serena will never compare to my fandom of Venus.
Right.
I think, and this is something that just keeps getting bigger and bigger every single year. And it's something that's even surprised me. And last year, 2014, was such a treasure to behold as a Venus fan. Because I think myself and most people felt that, you know, her best days were behind her, and they still probably are behind her, but her improvement, her physical improvement, and her results on the court were so heartening. And it started right off the bat in Auckland, reached the final, lost to Ivanovic. She was quite the thorn in our sides early last year. And then she followed that up with winning Dubai. She made the final in Montreal. Again, the final in Quebec City. That's four finals, one title. She played what many people consider the match of the year, myself included, absolutely, at Wimbledon.
Yeah.
I could not believe what I was seeing on TV when I watched it. Like, the clarity of decision on court, the power. It was as if I were transported to 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And honestly, that match was, to me, more cleanly played by Venus than her most famous final, the one against Lindsay Davenport.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you may remember she played really poorly for about the first half of that match. And then, you know, she flipped a switch and it was the greatest power tennis you've ever seen by both of them. But this matchup against Kvitova was so much cleaner.
In the last couple of years, we've gotten glimpses of what Venus can do, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. We haven't been able to see her string together matches or stretches of matches. But that Wimbledon, it's such a shame that it was the third round, because it was the culmination of everything we'd seen so far last year.
Mm-hmm.
And it was almost as if it were a gift to her fans. You know, it was such a bittersweet moment, because you felt that if she could somehow get by Kvitova, who is one of her more troublesome rivals on tour at mm-hmm. this point, then she could really have done some serious damage.
Oh, yeah.
And it just didn't happen. But then she gave us Montreal.
She beat her sister.
She beat her sister. That floored me.
Yeah.
Because she lost the first set, and everybody felt that if she had any chance at all in that match, she had to win that first set.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it be, you know, not being able to keep up with Serena physically or whatnot. But she came back and she won the last two sets fairly routinely. I think it was something like 2-3 or something
that.
Oh,
yeah, that's true.
She stormed mm-hmm. through the second set. And then when it got to that point in the third set, when you expected Serena to roar, literally, her way back to victory, Venus wasn't having it.
Yeah.
Of course, she didn't just run out of steam against Aga in the final. But, you know, it really gives me hope for 2015. Mm-hmm.
It does show you how important these matchups are in women's tennis, though. You know, she, like, Radwanska is a player who will give her trouble,
yes,
even on her best day, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And just because of her style of play, you know?
Yeah.
She likes big hitters.
And which is why Venus has these good high-quality matches against Kvitova. Because they just bang, bang, bang the ball, and they like it.
Right.
You know, and when they're on, it's really quite the spectacle. It's one of the best spectacles in women's tennis when those two are going.
I agree. Yeah.
And the best part about Venus's play is that she's raised her ranking.
Mm-hmm.
As we speak, she's number 19 heading into 2015. That's no small feat for somebody in her position.
Mm-hmm. And if you think if she could get a few rounds further in each slam, even one round further, her ranking could go way, way up,
mm-hmm.
you know, because she had, you know, relatively disappointing results in the majors based on how she played in other tournaments in the year.
I think one of the other big stories of 2014 was Federer. I keep saying a lot of people. What I should really say is myself. It felt like he was really on a downswing, because there were rumors about injury, but there weren't things that he were necessarily speaking about specifically. Mm. So it was hard to tell how much of his downward turn was due to injury, or, you know, he was 32 at the time, how much of it was Father Time catching up. And then he turns it right back around in 2014.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, he's a player who's never really talked about his injuries. And
well,
so,
he's never really had them.
Well, that's what
which
we,
is the most.
But that's what we think.
True.
Every athlete has injuries.
It makes us question
and
that
tennis
now,
players
right?
have tons of injuries, right? So I'm sure he's had injuries here and there that he just hasn't really talked about. Nothing like Rafa's, but this back injury in 2013 was obviously a huge bugaboo. You know,
he made 11 finals. And that's crazy. I watched the entire season and it didn't feel like 11 finals. I was actually surprised when I went back and looked at it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then he won 5 titles. And on top of that, he beat Djokovic 3 times. The difference for me with him, there's a difference of Novak actually winning a major, but the major difference why Djokovic rightly so was player of the year, not Federer, were the times when Federer wasn't able to beat Djokovic.
Okay.
You know, Roger beat him in a few semifinals, but when it came to final time in these tournaments, he wasn't able to really get the job done. Came desperately close at Wimbledon.
Right.
I can't imagine what that must have felt like for him.
Yeah, I mean, I think if he could have pulled off Wimbledon, then we would be talking about him as the player of the year, really. You know, even if Djokovic had won a different major.
Yeah. Which shows you how small those margins are, right?
Yeah.
We're talking about losing a fifth set 6-4.
That's the difference in being the best player of the year, you know. But at this point, with no majors, I don't think he's in the conversation at all. And I know this...
I know you were much more clear-cut about that when we were talking about it.
You know, if you don't win a major, you can't be the best player of the year. It's that simple for me.
Well, there are people who will disagree with you.
Oh, that's fine. And, you know, he won Davis Cup, but Stan Wawrinka also won Davis Cup.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was much more instrumental in keeping Switzerland where they were, you know? So Federer lost one match and won one match in the Davis Cup final. That's great, but it's not like, you know, hero's work to me.
It was just an impressive year all around.
Absolutely, yeah.
Australia semifinal, Wimbledon final, US Open semifinal. And those small margins, it could have been that much better.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, for me, the biggest disappointment, not personally, but I imagine for those two players, was the US Open men's semifinal. I remember being at work, knowing the match was going to happen, and just being the matches, because they were each playing somebody different. And it was just, the results were shocking. Like, how could both of them lose on the same day?
And they were both bad matches, too.
Yeah.
Like, they weren't close, you know?
That's probably my biggest surprise of 2014.
Yeah. Cilic? Or the way those semis went
just down. Those semifinals. I mean, I would have expected Nishikori to win that final myself. But given the two, who can really say?
If he had been fresh.
Yes.
Maybe. But the final wasn't even close either.
No.
It's horrible, you know?
I also think that Cilic winning that final is... It makes sense in how bizarre the second half of the season was. Because... I would have expected Djokovic to run through the hard court season. He finally picked up steam toward the end of the year, as he usually does. But it was really Federer who did his best work in the hard court season. It was almost as if people finished Wimbledon and then they took a couple weeks off and then nobody really knew what was going on for a couple weeks.
Yeah, it was very confusing. You know, Federer won Cincinnati, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's after he made the final in Toronto.
Right. But I really thought that Djokovic would kind of take advantage of Rafa being gone, too, and just, you know, eat up some more majors. I'm very thankful he didn't do that, but it's still sort of confusing.
Well, people talked about his impending fatherhood as being a major factor in his kind of up and down results during that time of the year.
Oh, okay.
But again, we don't really know.
I have no idea.
None whatsoever.
Never been in that situation and hope to never be.
But back to Toronto, that was a tournament that we went to, you know, living in Canada. And
hey,
and Tsonga won that tournament.
He did.
And we want to talk about him a little bit because it was so surprising that week for him, but it felt going to some of the matches and watching them on TV that this was a maturation for him. Like, maybe he had finally, at 29, maybe like Stan, the year before, finally coming into his own. He beat Djokovic, he beat Murray, he beat Dimitrov, and then he beats Federer in the final.
In order.
All top 10 players. And it was really impressive. And he didn't really look too pressed in doing it, you know?
No. Yeah, that's the thing, that it almost seemed easy, you know? And we've seen, like, flashes of it before. We've seen lightning in a bottle with him.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he's ever beaten that caliber of players in one tournament. That's amazing. I mean, Murray is effectively a top four player, really. I know I'm stretching the truth a little bit. But, you know, you beat three members of the big four in 1 week to win this tournament.
I suppose the detractors will say that, you know, it was best of three, it wasn't best of five. And that, yes, we've seen these flashes before, and we should expect the downturn as well.
Right.
It was still just very disappointing.
It was.
Because we're fans of Joe, you know?
Yeah. Oh, he has so much talent, and he has...
Charisma.
Yeah.
That was a bit of a RuPaul reference there. We won't finish the whole thing.
I think he just doesn't have the nerve. That's it, you know?
That's probably it. I think you've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah. He is the sort of quintessential French player. This isn't to be, you know, I'm not trying to insult French people or French athletes, but he has flair, and there's something magical about the way he plays, but putting it together is sort of where they falter, right? it's almost like the win isn't really as important as the style in which it's done.
We saw him earlier in the week. Nobody at the tournament was paying him any mind. Like, you could get you could get so many seats to watch his matches.
And he didn't really look that impressive.
No.
And he was wearing that stupid shirt that he tucked in, remember? Someone said he looked like Bob Hope. It was the kit was weird.
It was very strange. But then after winning Toronto, I'm wondering if he then thought, well, maybe I got to tuck it in the rest of the year, you know?
Yes.
And so it just never really went away. It was a strange tournament for outfits in general. Do you remember when Federer showed up for his first match?
No.
And he was wearing this massively oversized shirt.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was very un-Federerian.
Yeah, he always looked so polished and put together, yeah. But he was just swimming in the shirt. And then somebody on the team got the memo. And then he got the right size for the next matches, you know? So we spent a little bit of time talking about what happened last year. Let's move forward to 2015. But before we start, I'd like to issue a pardon of sorts to Stan Wawrinka. And I won't speak for all of the Rafa fans on Twitter, and they'll probably have my head for saying it. I'm a Rafa fan. I'm not going to hide that. And so the Australian Open was a bitter pill to swallow. But I feel like quite a few of the Rafa fans have held on to this grudge for a bit too long. I feel like maybe it's time to issue that pardon and we can all just move on from it. It's been a year after all.
I'm over it.
You're over it?
I'm totally over it. During the match, I was very upset.
You were very
because
upset.
Because Stanley, while Rafa was off on his injury timeout, was complaining to the umpire. And we didn't know exactly what he was complaining about. But it turns out he was bitching because the umpire wouldn't tell him the reason for the timeout.
Yes.
Right? And so, to me and to a lot of us, it looked like really poor sportsmanship. Mm-hmm. You know, when someone's on an injury timeout, you're sitting there complaining to the umpire. And it really, like, took the shine away. Because I've always liked Stan. And I wasn't able to be happy for him because of what I saw as this kind of poor behavior. But you know what? I'm totally over it. I wish him the best. I just hope he doesn't beat Rafa again.
Well, I feel like he's been unfairly labeled a poor sport. I feel like maybe it has more to do with him getting in his own way sometimes, and it's a mental thing as well. You know, there are certain players on tour who will focus on things that they shouldn't be focusing on at the most inopportune times for them. And I feel like that's been a hindrance for him in the past, and that was definitely not the right time for him to do that.
Yeah, it was very, like, non-Big Four behavior.
Yes. You know,
and we've been so spoiled by their
above-it-allness.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Federer would probably, well, he might carry on like that. No. Yeah, scratch that. Federer might actually do that. But the Big Four have generally been so well-behaved that we're kind of spoiled.
Yeah.
We kind of view Stan's behavior as amateurish, you know?
I mean, he did have that Mirka Gate incident toward the end of the year.
Yeah, which I think is totally her fault.
But
she
again,
called him a crybaby.
No, I understand that. I understand
they're
that.
They're on the same team.
Yes. But when it comes down to it, this is not something that you, as you said, expect from one of the top players.
Yeah, exactly.
He had assumed that position by the end of the year, and so it just felt a little bit jarring to see somebody just calling out Federer's wife in the middle of a point, you know?
And to be honest, I sort of appreciate that he engages and that he has a little bit of a quick temper.
Yeah.
It's something that I can relate to. It's it's far more human than watching Federer.
Yeah, you know? It can be a bit robotic on tour.
Yeah, exactly.
So speaking of Stan, he precipitated this next part of this podcast. By winning Australia, he really upended the narrative of the Big Four, right?
Yes.
Like, he broke through and paved a way, in a sense, for somebody like Cilic to come through at US Open and win that tournament as well. It was a strange year for men's tennis in that regard. We had Rafa gone for a fair bit. We had Murray, who was still trying to find his way back from injury.
Mm-hmm.
Federer was finding his way back from injury, as it turned out. And Djokovic was there or thereabouts for most of the year. So there was room for people to slip through, so to speak.
Right. It was the story of the year on the men's side. You know?
Rightly so. Have we gotten to a point now where the Big Four is a thing of the past, though? Was last year an aberration?
Well, the Big Four can only last so long, right? But I think we have another good year of the Big Four. I think that Murray is really set to compete at the highest level again. And I think I'm optimistic about Rafa's umpteenth comeback because he's done it so many times before, you know? I don't really see Stanley sustaining his level throughout the year. I think he'll have some great results, but to stay in the top four or top five, I don't know if it's in him.
It felt like if he were going to do it, he would have done it last year, and that didn't really happen, right?
Yeah.
I want to focus on Rafa and Andy a little bit here, because we really don't know what to expect from Rafa at this point.
No, we don't.
I feel perhaps, you know, his fans will be a little bit more lenient on him to start the year in Australia. Mm-hmm. What are the expectations for him in Australia? I can't imagine they're too high. But what they will really be looking forward to is seeing him win a 10th French Open.
Yeah. As far as Australia, I would be very surprised if he didn't reach the quarters. That's just my projection, you know. I think that his level of talent is so high that he can reach the quarters with not too much superhuman effort, you know.
But at the same time, last year it showed us that he does need, unlike Serena in her Serena Slam days, mm-hmm. he does need the time to play himself back into form. And yeah. If the courts are really quick, he can be vulnerable in Australia. You know, I just feel perhaps it'd be best for everybody to just temper expectations with him for a while.
Yeah. I mean, if he were making a comeback in Wimbledon, I would say, okay, let's get through the first round. Mm-hmm. But, you know, he has a history at Australia. It's probably his hardest slam, but, you know, he's played really well there.
And with Andy, it feels right that he should be playing his best tennis very soon.
Yeah, based on how he finished the year.
Yeah, and he hired Mauresmo, which scored him a million points in our books. You know, I don't really know what the specifics are in terms of what Mauresmo will bring to Andy's game, but I expect that after having had the better part of 6 months together, that they'd have worked it out. They seem committed to each other. And he seems to be physically better as well. He's just too talented to not be right at the top of men's tennis again.
Oh, yeah. And the people who are saying, oh, you know, is Andy sort of being shown the door by Raonic and Nishikori and Dimitrov? That's so laughable to me. You know, he's somebody who sort of conquered his mental problems, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
You know, he won Wimbledon. Has anyone ever had more pressure? Ever? Like, this is...
Ask Tim Henman about it.
Right. Exactly. You know, I mean, Andy Murray is a lot more talented than Tim Henman, who was no slouch.
Tim Henman play.
Yeah. Oh, he was really talented. But Andy Murray is on another level.
Totally. You
know? He has good records against the top players of his era, who also happen to be the top players of all time.
And he happens to have much more in his game than just a serve.
Right.
Which helps. Mm-hmm. Not taking any... Well, I guess I am taking some digs there.
I think Mauresmo, you know, like when she was playing, she had kind of every tool in the box, to use a cliche. You know, she had a really deft touch. She had power. She could play defense. And I think what she needs to show Andy is that attacking is always better, because he can volley. You know, he's a finesse player if he wants to be.
We saw a bit of the attacking toward the end of last year.
Yeah.
Especially when he came up against the top guys. That seemed to be his go-to.
Right. And, you know, like when Andy is playing defense and playing too passively, that's when he gets down on himself, and when he's not winning.
It's so hilarious, though, watching him mope himself into oblivion.
Yeah, I love it.
I will say this, though. The thing about 2014 and having Stan and Cilic win tournaments is that we are going to come to a point where the Big Four is a thing of the past. And 2014 definitely helped us prepare for that.
So I'm going to ask you a question. I feel like I know the answer, but it's something that a lot of people are talking about in tennis, have been talking about, and will continue to talk about. So we might as well address it. Is this the year that the Serena-Sharapova rivalry, or lack thereof, finally takes off? Considering
I wish you could see my face. But there is no rivalry. There never will be one. Serena could be in a wheelchair and there wouldn't be a rivalry.
Yes, I understand that. I know that that's your position.
Okay.
But Serena is number one. Sharapova is number two. They're separated by a marginal number of points now. It's conceivable that this year we'll see a lot of them. Mm. And who knows? Serena's getting older. Maybe Sharapova has found some secret.
If there had been an indication that she was getting closer, you know, I might be on board. Like, their last match at the French Open was more competitive than it ever has been, especially the first set. But there was still no, like, there wasn't a feeling that she could pull it off. You know, I think the points race is actually much more encouraging for Sharapova fans because she could become number one. She can't become better than Serena. I don't even think she can beat her, but she could certainly overtake number one.
There's no overcoming the head-to-head.
No, you know, no, there. But I mean, you're talking about changing the narrative late in Serena's career. You know, like getting a leg up, which is, I mean, conceivable, but I don't really see it happening. At least not this coming year. You know, there would have to be like a huge decline in Serena's play. I'm not joking. It's the truth. And Serena, as we know, gets up for these matches. These matches really, really motivate her.
But that has to be the biggest deciding factor, right? Because yeah. Serena's been troubled by Cornet. Like all these marginal fringe, you know, top 50 players who have given her trouble. But Sharapova, even when she's entering the match on a decided downswing, she still manages to rise. And yeah. it can't be just the matchup either. Like there has to be, like 2004 must be in her dreams, like every single night.
Probably. I mean, the Wimbledon final was extremely embarrassing. There's no other way to put that. And then to lose to her again in, what was it, the year in championships? It was a year in
championships, yeah.
You know, it was a really embarrassing stretch because Serena had a pretty bad year in 2004. She was going through some things in her personal life, which she talked about in her book. But she was coming off the Serena Slam. You know, she was destined to become one of the all-time greats. You know, people just don't record these kind of statistics. So to have this girl, this blonde girl, who everyone is saying is the next great player, beat her so easily.
And steal some of her money, let's
right.
be honest.
Well, that's like the story, right? That's what all the commentators say. And I don't think it's that simple. You know?
What do you mean?
I don't think it's like, okay, so Sharapova is the richest woman in tennis, and that makes me angry. You know, I don't think that's what Serena is saying to herself. But, you know, it may have some sort of small... It might be a small factor, but...
I feel like there must be a racial issue with it, too, when it comes to Serena, the way she views this whole situation. You know, like, Maria hasn't always been the most deferential toward her, nor has she been the most accommodating.
Which is...
A bit of a side note, but when you consider how she's just bulldozed her over and over and over again, like this is unprecedented.
And it's merciless.
It is.
It's
like, which makes me like, almost. There must be something that really riles her about Sharapova, and I wonder if race has something to do with it. You know, people try and put that onto their rivalry, and you know, we can never really, it's not something you can pinpoint. And say, yeah, this is what it is. But I really wonder how much Serena thinks about that at all. Of course, she'll never tell us.
No. And it's probably not for us to know either.
Which is how she, which is how she'd like it.
The way that Richard Williams talks and the way that he says he raised his daughters is like that race is kind of always a factor in how they interact with the outside world, right? That everything in their lives has been colored, so to speak, by being black. And that's true for, you know, every black American, right? I don't know. I have no idea what's going on in Serena or Venus's head. So, but I think beyond all the sort of outside factors, the psychological factors we're projecting on them, the matchup is just not good for Sharapova. You know, Serena is a player who does all of Sharapova's strengths just a bit better. You know, she's strong on both sides. She's faster than Sharapova.
She'll never be bothered by her pace.
Right. And she hits just as hard, you know? And Sharapova doesn't really have the variety to really mess her up. You know, Serena can be really put off by consistency and by, like, retrievers as long as she, like, if she can't hit through them, right?
Which is what happened in 2004. She just blitzed her off the court. Sharapova couldn't miss.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. So Sharapova's highs are very high. You know, like watching her in power mode is, it's not beautiful, but it's definitely impressive. But that really, it doesn't faze Serena that much.
So what people are, Sharapova backers are essentially hoping for is that she'll just clip for an entire 2 sets.
Like Lisicki did
at yeah.
Wimbledon, right?
That's what it will take.
Right.
You know, I never need an invitation to talk about Venus. I could talk about Venus morning, noon, and night. Where she is now is that she's starting the year ranked number 19. And if you remember, a couple of years ago, she said it was her explicit goal to make it to Rio in singles. And I remember doing the math and thinking that would make her 36. She's currently... like 192. Like, I just couldn't see a path forward for her, you know? And so...
to be clear, that was her ranking.
Yes.
Not her age.
A fictitious ranking, but you get the point. But she's gotten to this point now where it's a realistic possibility.
And
last year, she had these good results, but none of them came at the Grand Slams. I think her best result was 2 third rounds at Wimbledon and US Open. So conceivably, if she has a better year at the Grand Slams this year, she'll be collecting that many more points. And she has a realistic shot at cracking the top 10 by year's end.
You think so?
Yeah, I do. Hmm. I mean, this assumes that she stays healthy. But if she's able to build on what she did last year, there's no reason why. She can't. It's not as if the women in the top 20 are, you know, bastions of consistency. You know, they're threatening to careen out of the top 20 at any given moment, you know?
Yes. Careen.
So that's something that I'm really looking forward to this year. She's about an hour and a half from taking the court right now as we speak. Ooh. I've got my eye on the clock. She's going to be playing Sepulveda in Auckland, I think.
Mm-hmm. Serena's bugaboo.
Bugaboo. It was really just one.
Well, okay.
She's no Cornet.
or Monica Seles, Sharapova's toughest competitor ever.
That meme is one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Because it encapsulates their relationship or what we conceive their relationship to be so perfectly, you know?
And do you guys know what that is? Like, Sharapova was asked who is her toughest ever opponent. And she said, without even thinking, Monica Seles.
But this is after 7 or 8 other players had been asked the same question and they're all saying Serena. And so this one picture shows all these players and their faces with Serena under it. And then there's Sharapova at the end with Seles.
Like, excuse me. Did they play, what, like once? Was Seles like 35 when they played?
Seles was peaking in 2003, I'd like you to know.
Really? There's no disrespect because I love Monica Seles.
Love Monica Seles.
But, you know, but I understand. Maria loses to Serena like really, really badly for 10 years. And then you have to just add insult to injury by trying to force her to say Serena. So, you know,
You know, she makes better candy than Serena. She has that on her.
Excuse me? Does Serena make candy? Serena does nails. I know she sells stuff on HSN.
That is probably what I'm looking forward to most in 2015. Mm-hmm. I watched Serena on HSN for the first time this year, and you probably remember me laughing hysterically from the other room.
Can you imagine if she and Mariah do like a joint session?
I think my head would explode.
A retro moment of Gypsy whatever.
This is amazing. These leggings, they're just the best.
They are. I love this color. Festive. What were we talking about?
We were talking about Venus and her prospects for 2015.
You know, being a fan of Venus is really difficult. And you are like the fan.
I am a long sufferer. And
it's really almost masochistic.
It really affects my moods.
I know.
Just so many times last year, I'd be watching these matches in the wee hours of the morning, my time. And I'd be clinging to hope that she'd pull these matches out, these long, epic three-set matches laden with errors.
Mm-hmm.
And she's up a break in the third set, and then it just goes away, you know?
Yeah.
And it's soul-crushing.
And that's what didn't happen against Serena. And that's why it was so exciting.
Yes. You know?
I think, like, Venus is the latest stretch of her career. I don't know. This is probably, like, her fourth or fifth career at this point. Is exciting in its own way, you know, because the expectations are so tempered at this point. But she continues to defy them anyway. You know, the fact that she's even still playing is a big deal, but we shouldn't even be talking about it that way. Because she's still playing excellent tennis.
Yeah.
It's not like she's limping by.
There was a point 2 years ago when she'd give interviews and she'd talk about really needing to put the work in and she just needs practice and she'll get there. And who really believed that? You know, at that point, 2 years ago, she was the only one really believing in herself to that extent. And she's gotten her way. She's worked her way to this point. It's been nothing but hard work, diligence, and it's really a story of inspiration. We throw that around all the time. You know, this is inspiring, that is inspiring. But I defy anybody to look at Venus Williams's career in the last few years and not just be completely floored by what she's managed to do.
Yeah. You know, at this point, I don't know if anyone ever foresaw this in 1997, but she's the grand old lady of tennis.
She is.
You know, she's probably the most respected figure of women's tennis. Who's still active.
She's got herself an ESPN 30 for 30. You know, she's advocated for equal pay at Wimbledon. Her standing in the game is... Can you imagine if she had the 18 Grand Slams? Like, she would be... It would be unreal how we would consider her.
Right.
You know?
'Cause, you know, her personality has really morphed a bit over the years, you know? When she first came out, she was the shyer sister, right? But she was much quicker to anger and to kind of defend herself and her sister. And now she's regal.
Yeah.
You know, she's calm. She's unflappable on court and in her sort of media life.
She's the queen of the WTA, hands down. Let's finish this up with a little bit on Canadian tennis, because we are in Canada. We live in Toronto. And
tennis is Canada.
It is.
That's a hashtag, by the way.
And when tennis is on TV here, we're just inundated by the Canadian so-called stars.
Basically, during the majors now, if one of them are playing, that's the only thing you can see all day. On tape, live, whatever.
Serena or Novak could be playing their match. They'll be showing you Raonic in a routine three-set win. Because, you know, that's what we're being force-fed. But my problem with this is that I just find them all a bit boring. You know, for me, if you consider Raonic and Bouchard, the most interesting thing about the two of them combined is Milos's sleeve.
Which is weird.
It's very strange. Like, it has its own Twitter account. These things happen and people run with these weird things that they attach to players, but the sleeve thing is just a bit strange to me.
Yeah, and it's really not that interesting.
No.
But it is by far the most interesting thing about it.
Like, does it change color? Does it have
a different... It does, yeah. It does? It matches his kit.
Every time.
Like, it's part of his kit.
So it's not just black.
It looks like a friggin' mouse pad.
I will say that I do enjoy Pospisil.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, he is ranked 56th, so he's not quite the face of Canadian tennis just yet. But he has, you know, the Jack Sock doubles partnership going for him. They're exciting. You know, he's fun to watch. I'm so it doesn't help that I'm so bored by Boom Boom Tennis. You know, this serve for days kind of tennis to win matches. Tie breaks. Like, put Isner and Raonic in a barrel and just ship them somewhere to where tennis isn't played, you know?
Yeah, Raonic's game is really a throwback, you know, and not in a good way. A throwback to, like, the boring nadir of men's open-era tennis. What about Bouchard?
What about her?
The Queen of Canada.
Well, I remember being at the Rogers Cup this year, and while I was on center court, her match was being played in Montreal. And so we were getting these live updates of, I think she got bageled in the first set. She just got...
Yeah.
It was not a pretty sight. Because, you know, as you can imagine, she was hyped as this great draw for the women's event in Montreal, and it just didn't work out.
Yeah, it didn't. She had a really bad summer, you know. Which is to be expected after such an amazing spring.
Yeah. I mean, she had great results. I suppose, who are we to expect tennis players to give us more than just results? But I need to find something entertaining about it all, you know?
Right.
And I feel as though I'm being treasonous almost by having these thoughts about these Canadian players. Like, I'm a Canadian citizen now.
I'm not.
It's tailor-made for me to jump on this bandwagon, and I just can't, you know?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Is it something about the Canadian mindset? Are these players sort of typically Canadian in the way that they behave?
I have no way of gauging that.
I don't know. That's the thing. We live in Canada. We don't even know.
Yeah. it's
That's kind of a theme with Canadian identity, is that no one knows what it is.
You ask somebody what it is that makes what conjures Canadian, and they'll maybe tell you Wayne Gretzky. They'll tell you people, but they won't. There's no real cultural identity that you can pinpoint.
But it's usually in opposition to the U.S.
Yeah.
So it's like, here are the ways we're not American. But anyway, yeah, Bouchard, I was really put off by sort of her aloofness. You know, it felt like she was really putting on this persona of, I'm not here to make friends. Like, it was kind of reality TV, you know? I don't know. Maybe that's how she really is. I don't know. It seemed a little...
Is that forced. A bad thing, though? Not wanting to make friends on tour? Is that something that we should hold against?
Well, no, because... I don't know.
There was that great photo from Singapore where the top 8 women were sitting in some kind of lobby, and 6 of them were doing things... Mm-hmm. on their phone or, you know, chit-chatting. And there was Maria and Eugenie at the end just not having it, you know?
And, you know, people said that about Venus and Serena for so many years.
Yeah,
that they had no friends on tour, that they were unfriendly, Venus especially. They didn't talk to anybody, and we were supposed to kind of hate them for that.
And now look at Serena. She's besties with everybody in the top 10. Oh, my God.
Right.
She's Miss Congeniality.
That's something I never saw coming.
Yeah.
So maybe, you know, that's down the road for Bouchard.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Maybe she is young. She is, how old is she? 20? 21?
I think. 21?
Yeah, I mean...
Yeah.
Should we really expect these young players to be that socially developed?
No.
Considering all that they have to go through?
Because most of these players haven't even gone to school.
No.
They've gone to academies, you know?
You might even say they haven't had a formal education.
Like some famous Swiss tennis player we know.
And look, she's managed to overcome it.
Sort of. I did hear that her and her mother got in a big fight over a VCR. DVD player?
I didn't hear that part.
Oh, okay.
No?
It was with some ex-boyfriend or something.
Which tennis rags are you reading?
The Twitter people will know.
They will know, yeah. Maybe you guys can tell us.
And they'll be able to elucidate it further for me.
So tell us about the Martina Hingis VCR throwing scenario.
I didn't say throwing.
You didn't?
No.
Oh.
What? Just a fight regarding maybe a DVD player or a VCR or a combination. Perhaps.
When did this happen if it were a VCR?
Well, the last time she was relevant in singles, maybe.
That is shade.
Was that a read?
On that note, let us know what you think of our very first podcast. We've had a blast doing it.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah. Good. So hopefully we'll be back for episode 2 sometime in the near future. In the meantime, you can get in touch with us at my Twitter handle, Jonathan, is sportscribeca. And
mine is Elliot JMR. 2 L's, 2 T's.
Okay. And this is The Body Serve, at The Body Serve on Twitter. Thanks for listening. Hopefully you guys will like it and join us again next time.